Right now, there are over 9.1 billion active mobile phone subscriptions on this planet, which is, I mean, just think about that for a second.
Yeah, it's a staggering number. We are completely outnumbered.
Vastly outnumbered by a device that, just 50 years ago weighed over 4 pounds. And it was pretty much just a novelty item for like high-level corporate executives.
Right. It definitely wasn't a consumer gadget back then. But now it is arguably the most ubiquitous piece of tech in human history. It's saturated the entire globe.
Exactly. So welcome to the deep dive. Today we are digging into a massive stack of encyclopedic data, historical logs, tech specs, and some really fascinating sociological studies, all dedicated to that little device that is probably sitting right next to you right now.
Or maybe you're even listening on it right now.
Probably, yeah. Our mission today is to figure out how a chunky 2 kilo piece of plastic transformed into, well, the central nervous system of modern human existence. We're going to decode the invisible cells it uses, bust some really persistent battery myths.
Oh, the battery myths are huge.
They really are. And we'll explore how this tech accidentally rewired global culture.
And we really want to focus on the how and the why today, because the actual physics and the chemistry happening in your pocket, it's astonishing when you break it down.
It's deeply ironic, too, because you probably stare at this screen for hours every single day. Yet if someone asked you how your call actually connects without, crossing wires with the billions of other calls happening at the exact same time.
Most people would draw a total blank.
I know I did. So to understand the invisible tech running our lives, we have to start at the very beginning with the ultimate 1970s tech flex.
Right, the 1970s, this is where it shifts from science fiction to actual reality because, I mean, the concept of mobile radio was around. Ships used it, trains used it.
Really, car phones, right?
Exactly. But those car phones took up half your trunk, and they needed massive amounts of power from the car's battery just to transmit a signal. So the breakthrough for true portability, that happened on April 3rd, 1973.
Martin Cooper.
Yes, Martin Cooper. He was an engineer at Motorola. And he walked out onto 6th Avenue in New York City and demonstrated the very first handheld mobile phone.
Which weighed what, 2 kilograms?
Yeah, about 2 kilos, so over 4.4
I
pounds.
mean, you could do bicep curls with that thing.
Yeah.
But my favorite part of this story is what he actually did with that first phone call. Because he didn't call the president, he didn't call the mayor,
Yep.
he called his direct rival, an engineer named Joel Engel over at AT&T. And he basically just said, Joel, I'm calling you on a cell phone, but a real cell phone, a personal handheld portable cell phone.
It just does top-tier corporate trolling.
It really is the ultimate flex.
It was a massive triumph for Motorola, obviously, but it was just a prototype. It actually took another decade for the tech to shrink enough and for the infrastructure to be built before the public could actually buy one.
Right, the Motorola DynaTAC 8000X in 1983.
Exactly, the first commercially available handheld phone.
And when you look at the timeline of how the networks evolved after that, 1G, 2G, 3G, I was just thought of each G, each generation, as basically a speed bump for internet loading times.
Right, like 1G was slow, 2G was a bit faster.
Yeah, exactly. But looking at the technical specs in our sources, that's not really what happened at all. These were massive structural leaps.
That is a crucial distinction, yeah. It wasn't just about turning a dial to make things faster. Like, the leap from 1G to 2G was a complete paradigm shift in how information traveled through the air. So 1G, which launched commercially in Japan in 1979, that was an analog system.
Meaning what exactly? Like physically, in terms of radio waves?
Okay, so think of an analog signal like drawing a continuous wavy line on a piece of paper, right? Without ever lifting your pen.
Okay.
The radio wave is continuous, and the actual sound of your voice directly shapes that wave. It works, but it takes up a ton of space in the radio spectrum, and it's super prone to static.
Got it.
Now, 2G, which came out of Finland in 1991, that digitized the signal.
So instead of a continuous line, it's breaking the voice down into like ones and zeros.
Exactly. It samples your voice, chops it up into tiny digital packets of data, transmits those, and then reassembles them on the other side.
Wow.
And here is the hidden magic of that shift. Once you teach a network to transmit digital packets instead of just continuous audio, you aren't just sending voices anymore. You can send any digital data, which birthed SMS.
Short message service. Text
Yeah.
messaging.
Yes.
So texting wasn't just like a fun feature they decided to bolt onto analog phones. It was the direct result of the network itself becoming a digital packet delivery system.
Precisely. And I mean, That fundamentally changed human communication forever. Then 3G arrived in 2001, and that expanded the digital pipeline to provide mobile broadband, allowing for video calls.
And then 4G in 2009. And the industry logs we have show 4G was optimized specifically because carriers realized internet streaming media.
Like YouTube and
Yeah,
Netflix.
they realized streaming was going to completely overwhelm the 3G infrastructure. They just needed a wider pipe.
Which brings us to 5G, rolling out around 2019. 5G is fascinating because it utilizes millimeter wave technology.
Okay, let's break that down because millimeter wave sounds like marketing jargon.
No.
What is it physically doing?
Well, radio waves come in different lengths. Older networks used waves that were quite long, which is great for, traveling far distances and penetrating buildings. But millimeter waves are incredibly short, high-frequency waves.
Okay.
And because the frequency is so high, they can carry a massive amount of data. We're talking gigabit per second download speeds.
But there's a trade-off, right?
A huge trade-off. These tiny waves get blocked very easily by trees, rain, buildings.
Which explains why carriers have to install so many more 5G nodes on city streets
Yeah.
compared to like the giant sparse towers of the past.
Exactly. But the real game changer with 5G isn't just the speed, it's the latency.
The delay between sending a command and getting a response.
Right. 5G drops that latency down to just 1 millisecond. That near real-time responsiveness, that's the missing puzzle piece for things like autonomous vehicles. They need to talk to each other safely at highway speeds without any lag.
Okay, so knowing how the data evolved from continuous analog waves to gigabit digital packets, that makes sense. But there's a glaring mechanical mystery here.
Let's hear it.
We went from serving a handful of rich guys with car phones in the 80s to supporting 9.1 billion subscriptions globally today. But radio spectrum is a finite physical resource.
Yeah.
How does the air not just get completely clogged?
That bottleneck is exactly what early engineers faced. In the pre-cellular systems, a telecom company would put one or two incredibly powerful radio towers right in the middle of a city, and they broadcasted over tens of kilometers.
Okay.
But as you said, radio channels are limited. Let's say they only had 40 channels available.
So if 40 people are making a call, person number 41 just gets a busy signal.
Yes. The entire city's capacity was maxed out, and you couldn't just magically create more radio spectrum. So the genius solution was the cellular network, which is obviously where the term cell phone comes from.
Oh, right. So how does that work?
Instead of one giant tower shouting over the whole city, they divided the city into a grid of small geographic shapes called cells. Often, in a really dense city, a cell is only a kilometer or so wide.
And each of these tiny cells gets its own small low-power base station.
But wait, how does making the towers weaker and the coverage areas smaller solve the problem of not having enough channels?
Because it allows for a mathematical trick called frequency reuse.
Frequency reuse. Okay.
Imagine the radio spectrum is a set of colored flags. If a base station in cell A is using the red flag for a call, the base station right next door in cell B can't use the red flag, or the signals will cross and interfere.
That makes sense.
But a base station 10 blocks away in cell J, it can use the red flag. Because the base stations are intentionally low power, their signals simply don't travel far enough to overlap. Oh, wow. Let me see if I have this right. It's like reusing table numbers at a massive outdoor restaurant. As long as table 5 in the north wing is a mile away from table 5 in the south wing.
The waiters won't get confused about where to bring the food. That's
Exactly.
a great way to visualize it. The physical distance acts as the buffer. By keeping the broadcast power low and the cells small, an operator can reuse the exact same limited set of frequencies hundreds of times across a single city.
Allowing millions of simultaneous conversations.
Precisely.
Okay, but if the cells are so small and the towers are so weak, what happens when I'm like in an Uber driving across town? I'm rapidly leaving the North Wing and entering the South Wing. Why doesn't my call just drop the second I leave my current tiny cell?
Because of the handoff. And this is where your phone is doing a ton of invisible heavy lifting. Even when you are just walking down the street, your handset is constantly measuring the signal strength of the base station you're connected to.
While you're on the call.
Constantly. And simultaneously, it's listening to the base stations and adjacent cells.
So it's anticipating the drop.
Exactly. When the system detects your signal weakening in one cell and it sees a stronger signal available in the next, the network coordinates a handoff. It commands your phone to instantly switch to a new frequency in the new cell.
And that happens in milliseconds.
Milliseconds, usually without a single pop or click on your end.
It's basically a highly choreographed, invisible dance happening in the air around us constantly.
It really is.
But here's the thing. That brilliant network of geographic cells is completely useless if the device in your hand dies after 40 minutes.
Very true.
Which brings us to the physical brick itself. Specifically, the part that causes the most daily anxiety for people, the battery and the internal hardware.
Right, power management. It's the hidden war inside every mobile device. To make this work, the internal hardware has to be brutally efficient. Smartphones rely on central processing units, CPUs, that are heavily optimized for low-power environments.
Unlike a desktop computer, which can just draw whatever it needs from a wall outlet.
Exactly. And the technical specs also highlight a major shift in how phones store data, moving from NOR flash memory to NAND flash memory.
I saw that. Why does that matter?
That memory shift is a great example of the engineering trade-offs they have to make. So early phones use NOR flash memory. The benefit of NOR is that the processor can execute instructions directly out of the memory storage.
Which is why an old 90s flip phone would boot up the instant you press the power button.
Precisely.
But modern smartphones take like 30 seconds to turn on. So why did we downgrade the memory?
Because smartphones became pocket computers. They need massive amounts of storage for high-definition photos and apps and everything else. NAND flash memory offers vastly larger capacities, and it's much cheaper to produce than a NOR.
Okay, but there's a catch.
Right. The catch is that the processor cannot execute instructions directly from NAND storage.
So it needs a middleman.
Exactly. The data has to be copied from the NAND storage into the phone's random access memory before it can be used.
Okay, so if NAND is like the giant deep storage warehouse where all the materials are kept,
Right.
then RAM is the actual workbench where the processor does the work.
Right.
You have to carry the materials from the warehouse to the workbench before you can build anything. And that carrying time is why my phone takes 30 seconds to boot up.
Perfectly stated. But all of that moving data requires energy. And that power comes from lithium-ion or li-ion batteries, which became the standard, replacing the much older nickel metal hydride batteries.
And this is where the daily anxiety comes in, because the data shows these lithium-ion batteries are designed to endure between 500 and 2500 charge cycles before the chemical aging degrades their performance.
Yeah, usually that's when your phone stops holding a charge for a full day, right around that 1 to 2 year mark.
Which is so frustrating.
It is, but that degradation is just the chemical reality of how the battery works. Inside the battery, you have two sides, the anode and the cathode. When your battery is fully charged, all the lithium ions are packed into the anode side. As you use the phone, those ions physically travel through a liquid electrolyte over to the cathode side.
So it's literally microscopic particles walking from one room into another to release energy.
Yeah.
And plugging it into the wall forces them to walk back to the first room.
Yes. And over time, that constant physical movement degrades the internal structure. The rooms just get worn out. But here's the critical difference between those legacy batteries from the 90s and modern lithium-ion chemistry.
Let's hear it.
Older batteries suffered from a memory effect. If you didn't fully discharge them, they would sort of forget their total capacity. Lithium-ion batteries do not have a memory effect.
I'm almost afraid to ask this. Does that mean the advice to drain my phone to 0% to preserve the battery is wrong? Because I definitely still do that.
It is not just wrong, it is actively damaging your phone.
Oh, man. Really?
Yes. Discharging a lithium-ion battery to 0% forces too many ions out of the anode room, which causes severe structural stress to the battery's chemistry. They actually perform best and last the longest when kept at a stable state between 30% and 80% charge.
That is wild. I am literally stressing out my battery by applying 90s logic to modern chemistry.
You and millions of other people.
But wait, if keeping it in the middle is best, why does my phone catch fire or fry the battery when I leave it plugged in overnight at 100%? There has to be some kind of safeguard.
You're exactly right, there is. It's called a battery management system, or BMS. Think of the BMS as a digital bouncer for your battery's nightclub.
Okay, I like this. What does the bouncer do?
It monitors the voltage, the temperature, and the flow of current. Once the battery reaches 100% capacity, the BMS steps in and completely cuts off the incoming power from the wall.
It just stops letting electricity into the room.
Right. So while keeping it between 30 and 80 is optimal for longevity, overcharging isn't the catastrophic threat it used to be. The phone's internal software is actively managing its own chemistry to protect itself from your charging habits.
The device is babysitting us.
Pretty much.
All right, so we've got a device that manages its own highly volatile chemistry, accesses massive warehouses of memory, and seamlessly hops across invisible geographic grids. What happens when you drop billions of these incredibly capable devices into the real world?
That's where the sociological studies come in.
Yeah.
Because a technology this powerful doesn't just change how we talk, it acts as a massive cultural catalyst.
Yeah.
When a device becomes ubiquitous, the culture molds the technology to its specific desires, and vice versa.
And the data reveals some incredibly polarized ways this happens. For example, there's a study conducted by Motorola that found 1 in 10 mobile subscribers keeps a secret second phone.
Wow.
Yeah. Often completely hidden from their families, used exclusively for clandestine business dealings or extramarital affairs.
It creates a perfectly insulated avenue for a secret, secondary life. It's highly individualized. But if you look at the other end of the spectrum, the phone acts as a massive communal hub.
Right. The sociological records show that in urban India and many African villages, mobile sharing is the norm. A single phone might be owned by a local teacher, and the entire village uses it.
It radically changes traditional custom.
Completely. Instead of a messenger physically traveling from village to village to announce a wedding or a birth, it's all routed through this single shared device.
And because these mobile networks bypass the need to lay down thousands of miles of physical landlines, mobile phones spread faster in developing nations than literally any other form of
Are you
technology.
making sense?
And that rapid spread birthed entirely new economic systems.
The M-Pesa service in Kenya. This is the absolute wildest part of the research to me. We're talking about populations that were largely unbanked, meaning no local bank branches, no checking accounts, dealing almost entirely in hard cash.
Which is risky to transport and difficult to save securely.
Exactly. And then the telecom operator, Safaricom, steps in and launches M-Pesa.
It's brilliant in its simplicity. M-Pesa essentially turned the mobile phone SIM card into a secure digital bank account.
But how? How does a basic cell network securely handle financial ledgers without a banking app or high-speed internet?
By utilizing the very basic SMS text messaging infrastructure we talked about earlier, Safaricom realized that they were already perfectly tracking millions of digital SMS packets flying across their network. So they just assigned monetary value to a central ledger on their end.
Oh, I see.
A user goes to a local corner store, hands the clerk physical cash, and the clerk sends a secure encrypted text message to the central server, crediting that user's phone number.
Wow. So now the user can text money to a relative across the country who can then go to their local store, show the text authorization, and withdraw physical cash. They took the digital packets that were meant for sending smiley faces and turned them into a national currency system. That is an unbelievable leap in economic infrastructure.
It really is.
But it's not just economics either. The technology also molded itself to religion. The rabbinate of Orthodox Judaism in Britain officially approved the use of kosher phones.
Yes, a kosher phone is a device that has been intentionally stripped down by the manufacturer or the carrier. They remove the internet browser, text messaging, and social media capabilities.
Mainly to prevent immodest communication and to keep the youth from wasting time on the internet. And a very similar concept is used in Israel to allow essential medical or security workers to use a phone on the Sabbath without violating the strict religious prohibitions on operating complex electrical devices.
They restrict the phone down to its absolute barest essential mechanics,
Right.
which perfectly illustrates the neutrality of the hardware. The same plastic brick can be heavily restricted to enforce strict religious observance in London, or mathematically expanded to create a massive financial banking system in Nairobi.
It is the ultimate adaptable tool. But that, and there's a big unevilly. But here, all of this convenience, the banking, the endless communication, it comes with serious physical and psychological costs. Costs we're really just beginning to reckon with.
And the most immediate cost is privacy. The surveillance capabilities of a mobile network are staggering.
The tracking. I think most people assume that if they toggle the little GPS icon to off in their settings, their phone stops broadcasting their location. But the specs say that is completely false.
It is. Because even without GPS, your phone can be precisely tracked using a technique called multilateration.
Walk us through the math on this. How does multilateration work if my GPS is off?
Remember earlier when we talked about the handoffs? We said your phone is constantly pinging the nearby base station so the network knows which cell to route your incoming calls to?
Right, the invisible dance.
Well, radio waves travel at the speed of light, which is a known constant. When your phone sends out a ping, Tower A might receive that ping in exactly 1 microsecond.
Okay, so it measures the time.
Yes. But Tower B, which is slightly further away, receives it in 1.2 microseconds. Tower C receives it in 1.5.
So because the network knows exactly where its towers are, and it knows exactly how long the signal took to reach each one, it just draws intersecting circles based on the time delays. Where the circles overlap, that's the phone.
Precisely. By comparing those microscopic time differences, anyone with access to the network data can triangulate your geographical location in real time.
Looking at the data, it's clear this isn't just a theoretical math problem. This multilateration tracking is heavily used by law enforcement and intelligence services in the US and UK. It was proposed by the government in China to monitor the commuting patterns of Beijing residents. And it is actively exploited by hackers who only needed the subscriber's phone number to pinpoint their location.
That's pretty scary.
We are paying for and willingly carrying highly efficient tiny spies in our pockets.
It's an unprecedented level of surveillance voluntarily adopted by the public. But beyond the data privacy costs, there is an immense physical toll on the planet, too. The average user replaces their mobile phone every 11 to 18 months.
That rapid turnover is insane.
It leads to massive amounts of electronic waste, millions of lithium-ion batteries and circuit boards discarded annually. And it's not just the waste at the end of the phone's life, it's the human cost at the beginning.
Yeah, the historical reporting is really dark here. A Guardian report detailed how the soaring demand for the metals and minerals used in these complex integrated circuits has directly fueled armed conflict.
Right.
Specifically, the Second Congo War in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which claimed millions of lives, was heavily financed by rebel groups extracting and selling conflict minerals that were essential for the global electronics industry.
The physical device in your hand is the endpoint of a deeply complex and often violently troubled global supply chain.
And finally, there is the mental cost, the psychological impact of carrying the entire internet, your bank, and your social life on your person at all hours.
The distraction factor is immense. A simulation study conducted at the University of Utah looked specifically at texting and driving. They found a six-fold increase in distraction-related accidents when a driver was texting.
Six-fold.
Yeah. The impairment was so severe that researchers equated the level of negligence to drunk driving.
That is horrifying.
Yeah.
And it's bleeding into education, too. A major study by the London School of Economics found that when schools simply banned mobile phones from the premises, pupils' academic performance increased. The bump in test scores was so significant, it was mathematically equal to adding one extra week of schooling to the year.
Which forces us to ask critical questions about how we integrate this tech moving forward. Technology itself is value neutral. A millimeter radio wave isn't inherently good or evil. But the sheer ubiquity of the smartphone, the fact that its design demands our constant fractured attention, it requires conscious management. We have to actively weigh how much of our data, our privacy, and our focus we are trading away for the convenience of staying connected.
It really is a profound trade-off. Well, we've covered incredible ground today. We started with Martin Cooper's massive 4-pound prank call in the 70s, mapped out the invisible geographic cells and automated handoffs that keep 9.1 billion of us online, and finally put the 0% battery myth to rest.
Seriously, let the BMS do its job and keep it between 30 and 80%.
Listen to the expert people. We saw how a simple radio device morphed into a robust banking ledger in Kenya, a kosher tool in Britain, and a major focal point for privacy and e-waste debates worldwide.
It is a remarkable evolution in just 50 years. The next time you plug your phone in, take just a second to appreciate the physics involved, the invisible multilateration, the endless frequency reuse, and the massive unseen supply chains making that little glowing rectangle function.
And I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over. Over the last few decades, our phones have systematically absorbed and replaced our maps, our physical wallets, our cameras, our stereos, and our flashlights. Everything is converging into this one device. So what happens when the physical phone itself inevitably disappears?
Oh, that's interesting.
Right. When the hardware shrinks down into our smart glasses or gets integrated directly into our biology via neural interfaces. We started today by talking about how a phone used to look like a high-tech brick. But when the brick vanishes entirely into the invisible, will we even notice the transition?
That is the ultimate question for the next generation of connectivity.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.